from KQED.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Penny Nelson. Well, it's been a month since the deadly campfire swept through the towns of Paradise, Magalia, and Concow, displacing some 50,000 people. Just this past weekend, residents of Paradise were allowed back into what remains of their homes. Many of those folks are now relying on the aid of FEMA. KQED's Michelle Wiley has more.
In the aftermath of the campfire, there have been numerous calls on the Disaster Relief Agency to get FEMA trailers on the ground. Officials say that so far, 189 mobile housing units and RVs have been purchased and assigned to families. Here's FEMA spokesman Frank Mansell.
We have no problems on the supply end. We're very comfortable with drawing trailers from, if there aren't in Northern California, they're in Southern California. If they're not in Southern California, they're in Nevada. So it's no problem getting the trailers. It's just a matter of going through the process.
That process involves finding places to put them that have utilities and services. According to Mansell, the agency has revised its estimate of how many trailers will be needed, down from 2,000 to fewer than 1,500. The deadline to apply for aid from FEMA is January 11th. For the California Report, I'm Michelle Wiley.
Moving down to the border, many of the thousands of Central American migrants encamped in Tijuana say they came to seek asylum in the U.S., but most don't know much about the U.S. immigration system or changes under President Trump that make it harder to win asylum. KQED's Farida Jabla Romero reports some California lawyers are trying to help.
At a migrant shelter in Tijuana, Norvia Dionisia Romero hopes to find a blanket from a pile of donations to bear the cold winter nights. She says she didn't expect to be waiting for weeks to ask U.S. officials for asylum. In Honduras, she sold vegetables at a market stand. But a gang member killed her nephew and threatened to kill her unless she paid him a weekly fee. She says after months of scraping up the money, she couldn't do it anymore.
Ya no aguantaba, ya no podía más.
The 39-year-old joined the caravan hoping to reach her sister in Minnesota. But now that she's made it to the border, she has no idea what will happen to her in the U.S. after she asks for asylum.
No sé. No sé nada de eso.
That's common among migrants fleeing violence, says Nisa Knox, an immigration attorney with Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland.
Like, they're fleeing for their lives, and so they're not stopping to, like, get information.
Knox represents asylum applicants. Most didn't realize they'd be detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement for months or separated from relatives.
Not knowing that that's going to happen makes it so much worse.
This month, Knox traveled to Tijuana with other volunteer attorneys to talk to migrants about how the asylum process works so they can make a more informed decision on whether to go for it.
You know, a lot of these folks do have good claims, but again, without knowing the law and without having attorneys, they may not be able to put those forward.
Government figures show only 1 in 10 people without a lawyer won asylum in 2017, compared to half of those who had a lawyer. Norvia Dionisia Romero says she wants to talk to an attorney, but as she waits in the backlog of asylum hopefuls in Tijuana, she has a more urgent priority. Finding work so she can survive the days ahead in Tijuana. For the California Report, I'm Farida Jabala Romero.
So it was 2 years ago today that a homeless couple was shot and killed in San Francisco's Mission District. And still, the murders of Lindsay McCollum and Eddie Tennessee Tate remain unsolved. KQED's Peter Arcuni spoke with Lindsay's mother.
Every time I walk by a picture, every time I go into Trader Joe's and see, like, dehydrated strawberries that she used to like, you know, it's like this flood of emotion and this wave of grief that just knocks me to the ground.
Carrie McCollum's daughter, Lindsay, was 27 years old when she died of gunshot wounds on the pavement near the corner of 16th and Shotwell, where she and Tennessee were living in a box. It was around 8:45 p.m. on a cold night 1 week before Christmas. Lindsay's beloved pit bull, Lily, was found beside her, covered in her blood. What Lindsay's mother wants people to know is that before her daughter's struggles with heroin addiction and mental illness, before 3 years on and off the streets, she was more than a statistic.
She was good. She was talented. She was smart. She loved animals, her little doggies, and she just lost her way. but that doesn't mean she deserved what she got. She was a person, and she deserves justice.
This summer, Lindsay's mom began offering a $5,000 reward for information about her daughter's killer. She had signs printed and hung on the corner where Lindsay and Tennessee were shot.
I felt like we were being forgotten, and Lindsay was being forgotten.
So far, it's led to some kind words and one tip that led nowhere. Still, she holds out hope that someday someone will come forward to shed light on what happened that December night. The San Francisco Police Department confirms that 2 years later, no arrests have been made, and there's not a lot of movement in the case. An SFPD homicide detective, who asked not to be named, told us about the challenges of investigating the murder of someone who's homeless. Potential witnesses have no fixed address and are generally fearful of speaking to the police. Carrie now lives in Knoxville with her husband. She recently had a memory quilt made from all the clothes and dance costumes she saved from Lindsay's childhood. She picked it up a few weeks ago.
Every little piece of material, I could see a flash of her when she was wearing it. I asked the lady to make it very bright and happy, and she did a great job.
On the 2-year anniversary of Lindsay's death, Carrie McCollum plans to be with her other daughter, spending time and trying to get through the day. For the California Report, I'm Peter Arcuni.
Meanwhile, at the border, around 2,000 migrants from Central America are still sleeping in tents at a former concert venue in Tijuana. Many are waiting to apply for asylum at the U.S. port of entry. As Emily Green reports, government officials in Mexico and the U.S. are keeping a close eye on their health.
At El Baratal shelter in Tijuana, Juan Hernandez of the Tijuana Public Health Department is one of 8 nurses giving out vaccines.
Hepatitis B, influenza y tétanos. ¿Gusta que se la apliquemos?
Hepatitis B, influenza, and tetanus, he asked one woman. Do you want us to give you the shots? Yes, she answers. Hernandez directs her to another nurse, who gives her the 3 shots in her arms. Hernandez says Mexican public health officials have given out more than 1,500 vaccines to kids and adults in the caravans. He says the vaccination push is preventive more than anything. Most of the migrants here at El Baratal are sleeping outside in tents on the concrete ground. During the day, it's nice out, 50s and 60s, but at night, it's cold and rainy. All of those factors increase the possibility of some sort of outbreak, says Salvador Morales. He's in charge of public health at the shelter.
En la temporada es para todo el mundo, más en condiciones de tanta proximidad física.
He says it's flu season, and that's a concern for everyone, and especially for people living in such close quarters. So far, the biggest health issue has been a small outbreak of chickenpox, about 6 or 7 cases. Still, public health officials in Tijuana and San Diego are in contact and keeping a close eye on communicable diseases. Wilma Wooten, San Diego's public health officer, says an infection like hepatitis A could be particularly problematic.
So if they were exposed in Tijuana and they happened to get across the border and end up in one of our shelters, it could take a month or more before the disease is demonstrated, and then they could be infecting other individuals.
Wooten said the San Diego County Public Health Department donated 600 doses of hepatitis A vaccines for the migrants. For the California Report, I'm Emily Green in Tijuana.
It's now been 5 weeks since the start of the devastating Camp Fire up north, and a few Butte County residents are still hospitalized with burn injuries. KQED's Anna Kusmer reports.
During a forest fire, most burn victims injure their arms and hands as they try to get out of danger or save their belongings. That was the case for most of the 12 people injured in the campfire. They were treated at the UC Davis Medical Center, where one man died of his injuries last week. 3 are still in treatment, with 1 in critical condition. Burn Center Director Tina Palmieri says for every percent of the body burned, they expect around a day of recovery. So if 30% is burned, that could mean at least a month of treatment.
The burn happens very quickly, but it gets better very slowly.
The center was prepared for a lot more patients, but the speed and intensity of the campfire meant that those who were close enough to the fire to get burned probably didn't make it out. They expected around 100 people, but only got 12.
In a wildfire, it's unpredictable in terms of when people get injured and when they actually can get to medical care and how they can come out to get to medical care.
Palmieri says a majority of the burn victims were older, over 50, and also sustained respiratory damage from smoke inhalation. For the California Report, I'm Anna Kussmer.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems. The James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. And Collective Health. American employers are in the healthcare business. It's time they had the technology to drive it. CollectiveHealth.com.
So we've told you that all evacuation orders from the campfire lifted in Paradise over the weekend, and many people drove back in to assess their burned homes. But the fire did spare the occasional house. The California Report's Polly Stryker has this story.
Steve and Kari Yerotis, ages 64 and 60, have the lone house standing in their immediate neighborhood. It's nearly 3,000 square feet, vaulted ceiling, wood stove, deck overlooking a valley of trees. We go inside.
There's no water, no power, no...
You'll see in the kitchen, there's a houseplant that is just, you know, dead.
The home is a time capsule to November 8th, when the campfire forced them to evacuate.
Everything is the way it was when we left.
It's amazing.
Oatmeal or something on the counter.
Cream of wheat with raspberries. Pardon the odor, but that's our refrigerator. Don't open the refrigerator.
Yeah, don't do that.
It's bizarre, but the smell is about the only thing wrong with the home, when almost everything around them lies in ruins. I asked Kari how she feels about this.
Very, very mixed. I'm not super excited that it's standing, but I just think limits a lot of our choices, and most of our friends are leaving and not rebuilding, and my job was up here.
They don't have the choices that their friends do because their house is still there. They won't get a total loss on their insurance, likely just smoke damage. But they can't move back yet, so they're living in a single-wide mobile home with friends in Chico. If they could leave, would they?
Now? Probably. Yeah, probably. It's really hard because all of my family's lost their homes and our friends, and so it's kind of like... our paradise is gone.
There was one thing Steve had to get from the house before they headed back into Chico.
It's very dear to me this time of year. It's my red and white suit.
It's his Santa. He's been Santa every year. And he's been Santa every year.
Normally, Steve would be all booked up for the holiday, but...
You know, but it's like there's no parties in paradise this year. No Christmas parties.
Their plan had been to sell in a couple of years so they could retire in Chico. But with the uncertainty in the real estate market and the future of Paradise, that's all on hold now. At some point, Steve and Kari will probably have to come back to live in a town they hardly recognize. For the California Report, I'm Polly Stryker in Paradise.
And that's the California Report for Tuesday, December 18th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Penny Nelson, and hey, Mom, happy birthday.